Hello and welcome to the Sewers of Paris. The topic this week is the Book of Mormon, classical music, and The Office. When it's time to start a new life, how do you decide what to shed and what to keep? My guest this week is Matt Olaszewski, also known as the Shirtless Violinist. He came to terms with being gay at a silent retreat, but after his family learned the truth, he had to endure a hostile home life until he finally climbed out a window with only the things he could carry. These days, he's gained fame online for music videos featuring gay love stories, but it took a lot of time to rebuild a new life that brought him the joy of creating art with the man he loves. We'll have that conversation in a moment. First, I just want to let you know about a new project I've announced. You've probably heard me talk about my show Queens of Adventure, a comedy storytelling podcast where drag queens play Dungeons and Dragons. Well, for the first time ever, we're taking our cast on the road, bringing them to Chicago to record a dozen hours of new adventures with local drag artists and D&D shows in the Midwest. There's a Kickstarter underway to make the trip possible, and if you support the project now, you can get some gorgeous nerdy gay enamel pins, bonus episodes, and even guest on an episode of the show. Head over to queensofadventure.com and click the banner at the top for all the details on our ongoing Kickstarter campaign. It ends on September 14th. Now, here's Matt. Well, this week I'm speaking with Matthew Olaszewski, the Shirtless Violinist. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you, Matt. Glad to be on.
So what is the entertainment that changed your life?
You know, it was several things along the way. The first thing that I was exposed to were Broadway musicals as a kid. My mom was a huge fan of Broadway musicals, and she, growing up in New York City as a little girl, got to go and see a huge number of musicals. So We listened to that growing up in our home as little kids. We could sing and knew all the lyrics to countless Broadway musicals. And these were really old ones back when she was a little girl. And that really kind of, that and classical music were played in our home. So that really left a big impression on me. Classical music, that was everywhere. I played the violin as a little kid, so that was just kind of work. That was a chore I had to do. But the Broadway musicals were so much fun and so clever. And so, yeah, I think that was really the first thing. It wasn't until I was much older, actually an adult, that I actually got to start going and seeing my first Broadway musicals. And that's a life-changing experience. I've seen a few that I'll never forget.
What was the balance when you were a kid of stuff that you liked of that world to stuff that was just sort of, you said it was kind of a chore, like with some of the classical music. So was there stuff that you actually looked forward to?
Yeah, you know, I think whenever my mom would pull out a brand new Broadway musical and introduce us to her favorite songs from that one, I mean, that was really a delightful experience. It was usually on big, long family car trips. So she would prepare, her favorites. And when we were driving, we did a lot of camping trips in the summer. So it was often driving we lived in the Midwest, so it was usually driving the Colorado to go camping up in the mountains for a couple of weeks. And those were long drives. So she'd pop in to the car stereo, a brand new Broadway musical, and we'd listen to it. And then we'd listen to it again and again and again. So I always really enjoyed that, looked forward to it. Classical music, I always enjoyed, but it had just always been there. So to me, it was almost commonplace.
What were the top musicals? Like, and did you sing along to them? You said you listened to, like, as a family, right?
Oh yeah, I mean, it was Sound of Music, Peter Pan, Flower Drum Song, a really old, like all of the Rodgers and Hammerstein stuff. That was really her favorites, her go-to. Phantom of the Opera, South Pacific, Annie Oakley.
There's a lot of, like, golden age, of at least when they were made into films, when the musical was, like, big.
Yes. Yeah. You know what she would say? It was funny because she saw original casts do these Broadway shows as a really young girl. Her grandparents would take her to see Broadway shows. And it was every time we watched the movie version, she would talk about how much better the original Broadway cast was. So she was an original Broadway cast person. She wanted the original recordings, and So yeah, it was a fun experience.
Did you have an interest in pursuing music yourself at that time, or did you were you like I want to do this, or was it just like a fact of life, like this is just what people do?
Yeah, it was really just what people did. You know, when I started at the age of three, I don't even remember that. So I'm sure like any three-year-old, I was excited about whatever I was introduced to. And it was just part of daily routine. It was as commonplace as brushing your teeth and eating dinner. You know, you practice the violin. I never really thought too much about it outside of that. There were certainly days I wanted to practice. There were days I didn't want to practice. There were days I hated practicing. But, you know, all through that, I always enjoyed playing the violin, performing. That was rewarding. But practicing was usually a chore.
What did you like about performing?
A couple of things. Number one, the sense of accomplishment. The fact that I had spent maybe 6 months, maybe a year and a half preparing and perfecting a song to perform for people. And that sense of accomplishment of watching something go from being impossible, a new song that I couldn't even play more than a couple of notes from, to being able to perform it, you know, at my level, proficiently and with artistry and to the best of my ability. So just watching something develop over time and seeing the consistency of daily practice pay off was really rewarding. And then, you know, even as a little kid, people would come up to me after the recitals and compliment me and, you know, say how beautiful it was. So I began to really feel good about the fact that my music seemed to, you know, make others happy and bring joy to them and bring some beauty into their lives.
What were those performances like? Like, were you performing with other people around your own age?
Yeah. So at an early age, we had recitals where we got to perform individually kind of for each other. It was like a music studio recital where all the kids of a particular teacher got together a couple of times a year and performed with a piano. But, you know, it was really solo violin with piano. We also had opportunities in the summers to play with other kids and perform little groups called quartets or trios. That was really fun to play with other kids my age who were also doing this. Because as I got older, I realized that not everybody practiced the violin every day. And sometimes I felt bad that, you know, after school, kids could go out and play, but I needed to practice the violin. So it was really fun to meet other kids who did it. And we'd sometimes, I think it was about the age of 12, from about the age of 12 on, we always played with a youth symphony. So that was an orchestra composed of kids who all, you know, played different instruments. And that was an incredible experience because you saw the power of just emotion and sound and beauty that could be brought together by, you know, 60 people all playing an instrument.
Is that what you saw as your future? Like, were you like, okay, this is what I'm doing and it's what I'm good at and it gives me a feeling of accomplishment and this is just where my trajectory is going to take me in life?
No, certainly not. you know, it was just something I did, something I was good at and getting better at. But I never thought like this will be my profession. In fact, even at the age of, I think, 14 or 15, teachers were starting to talk to me about it and wanting me to make the decision. And I played for a conductor from New York City at the age, I think, 12 or 13. And he was like, you know, you've got to get into a pre-collegiate division of a really good music school and get started. But, you know, I was not there. That's not what I was thinking about was making a career choice at that age. I was just enjoying being a kid and playing the violin. It just kind of happened. It just kind of happened where at one point I started teaching violin and enjoying that because I had some people ask if I would teach. So yeah, I started with one student who fainted at his very first violin lesson.
How did that happen?
I think he was nervous. I think he was probably as nervous as I was, or maybe more nervous. So he just toppled over in the middle of the violin lesson, and oh. I caught his violin let him hit the floor. So that's where my priorities were. Oh. But I enjoyed teaching. I mean, after that very traumatic experience, I had some more students. I decided I loved kind of instilling a love for the violin and classical music in the next generation. And I mostly teach children from as young as 2 to 14. That's the typical range. And they're usually great to work with. And then after that, I started playing with a couple of orchestras, a chamber orchestra, a ballet orchestra, an opera orchestra. And I discovered that that was really rewarding as well.
How much, when you were in that age range, that like 2 to 14, how much of your friend circle, your social circle, were other orchestra kids?
Good question. So I should say I was homeschooled. So my social circle was a little bit unusual. My circle of friends were mostly homeschoolers. We got together like once a week with our peers who were part of a homeschool group in the area. And so out of them, I was the only musician that I can remember. It was really only in the summers when we would do these summer music camps where you would meet a whole bunch of other families with kids for a week, usually on a university campus because they are not in use during the summers. We'd get together and we'd have one solid intensive summer camp week of music. So those were the highlights of my year musically.
That sounds great that like you were able to find a context where like the music was something that you had in common with other folks. Was that like a safe haven for, okay, I guess I'm not the only one after all.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. When, you know, I was part of every violin teacher who I took from always had a large studio, and we saw all the other kids once a week for group lessons, and we got together and played a couple of times a year. So there was always that sense of community within the town or city that we lived in. But going to these summer camps every year, you really got the sense that people from around the country and sometimes even around the world were also doing the exact same thing. So it was pretty incredible.
Did you find being homeschooling, like, and I know like it's hard to say without like a basis for comparison, but did that make the world seem very, I don't know, small, or like did it seem very like that you were very insulated from the rest of the world?
Well, you know, besides being homeschooled, I grew up in a very religious environment. So we were definitely insulated. That was a choice my parents made. So we were definitely insulated from a lot growing up. That was a byproduct of religion. So,
and I'm sure, you know, the musicals that you're consuming, those like happy, peppy Broadway musicals, don't exactly present you with the full rich complexity of that. It's not like you're going to see Rent, for example.
No, you know, it was only after coming out and leaving home that I got to see some different musicals. And I mean, one of my all time favorites is The Book of Mormon. I saw it once, and it's a musical I go back and see again and again. Yeah, and those were not musicals we were listening to as kids.
When you had those music camp experiences, did that at least give you a glimpse of a richer, wider world out there?
Yeah, for sure. We were meeting teachers. I mean, I was meeting teachers and other students, music students from around across the country, around the world. Especially the teachers, there was often an international faculty there. So. It was very rewarding, very enriching experiences, and something that I encourage my students to do. I mean, here in Seattle, we have a local summer camp. We actually have a couple, and I'm always telling them to go. I'm saying, you'll love it. It'll be the highlight of your year. This summer, I had a couple go to the Seattle Rock Orchestra summer camp, which they absolutely loved. I mean, playing rock music on a violin is going to expand your world when with me, you're just, you know, playing Bach and Vivaldi most of the time. So, I think it's an amazing experience, and I, you know, try to get all of my students to go.
Did you have any impulse, like, at that time to, get away from the very small religious world that you were in? Did you feel like you needed to get out from under that, or was it something that was comfortable for you?
You know, it was comfortable until my parents separated. They first separated, and then a couple years later, they divorced. And I think that was kind of the beginning of realizing that things weren't comfortable, things weren't okay. And it was during that time, after their divorce, that I think I first started to confront the fact that I was gay. And that definitely created an incredibly uncomfortable environment.
Yeah, I can imagine it wouldn't have been... It wouldn't have felt like either a safe place or a safe time to make any big announcements, or to for this announcement in particular to be what you brought to the rest of the family.
Yeah, no. I've said to myself, like, this just can't happen. I may be gay, and I was really hoping that I wasn't. And which is funny to think back on, because, you know, the first indication to me that I was gay was the fact that I loved the men's underwear section of the JCPenney catalog. And here, years after that, I'm hoping that I'm not gay. And I just really thought, this does not fit into this world. The world that I live in, it doesn't fit. So it's just, I can't act on it. I can't do anything about it.
So where did you go with that? Like, how did you journey out into the world, and when did you find the right time and place to come out?
Well, the right time and place kind of came to me unexpectedly. At least it happened. I'm not sure if it was the right way to happen. But one of the things that we did as we got to be teenagers was my mom really... thought that a silent retreat was a great kind of a mental health thing, a good way to disconnect from technology, social media. So as kids, we each got to do a silent retreat. And I went on my first silent retreat, and it was an extraordinary experience. I would still do one again today. In fact, I long to do one. It was beautiful. It was set out in the countryside. It was a beautiful area. It was a religious silent retreat. So it was run by a group of monks, actually. But the retreat wasn't only for people who were of that religious persuasion. It was really for anybody. But you were quiet all day. You disconnected from all technology for the entire week. And you didn't talk at all to anybody. Your meals were delivered, you know, you could come and go. And what they really wanted you to do was journal. So you started to, as the silence grew and as you disconnected from busyness in the world, you could start to listen to your thoughts and listen to what was going on inside of you. And you would start to write about that. And so as I started to write, they did have what they called a spiritual director, who would come and check on you once a day and kind of sit down with you and talk and see where you were going and see if they could provide some guidance, which for me was usually just kind of, my spiritual director would say, I want you to really kind of dig in there. You're writing really nicely, like you're writing like a letter home or a nice book. He's like, I want you to access some deeper emotions and really rip into this page, even if you're literally writing and the pen is digging holes in the page, because you have some feelings to let out. So I eventually did that. It took a couple of days to kind of get comfortable with that, but I wrote... filled this, you know, several hundred pages, and I left there feeling so good. You know, what I really ended up writing about was the fact that I was gay and how was I going to deal with this in my living situation with my family. And so I left not having an answer, but really feeling a peace about the fact that I had dealt with it and really accepted that I was gay. This was me. How am I going to deal with this? I don't know how. So I left with that journal, and I came home and I thought, I don't want my mom to find this, so I should throw it out. I should get rid of it, but I can't get rid of it because it means so much to me. This represents so much that I dealt with internally. So I hid it. And a couple of weeks later, I was off at a concert performing with a symphony, and I got a call from my mom, and she said, I discovered your notebook, and I read it. And I was ready to die at that point. I was like absolutely devastated. So that was the moment that it kind of all, you know, it all came out right then.
On the phone, from a distance?
Well, you know, over the phone, I was not ready. So I tried to deny it. I said, you know, what I was writing about was in the past. It's not current. I'm not. Mm-hmm. And because I was really not prepared for that. And I was also too in shock, too much in mm-hmm. shock that she had just read what felt to me like a very private journal. So I got home and for a while I was trying to convince her that it was just a phase, because I was not ready to deal with it. But I realized that was not going to happen. I was not going to be successful at that. So she said, well, you know, I want you to get conversion therapy or reparative therapy, and to buy some time, I agreed to go to a conference, a reparative therapy conference. And it was there that I discovered that no one was repaired there. They were all very gay and very sad, depressed. But they were all very gay. And, you know, I got hit on and had some fun when we, you know, especially when we were not in the conference during mealtimes and at breaks. You know, I had some fun meeting some wonderful gay guys. And I came back from that, and I said to her,
"When you say had some fun, or like romantic fun, or dating, or flirting fun?
Just flirting. Nothing more than just flirting. I made some friends who I stayed in contact with for a long time. These guys were very supportive of me." You know, especially as I first came out, and I'd call up some of them for advice from time to time.
Were these folks who were like bought in on the ex-gay, pray away the gay kind of stuff, or were they skeptical?
You know, it was really interesting that the people, everyone that I talked to, really didn't seem to believe that was possible, that you could undo it. No one did. It felt like for them, there was this real back and forth between like acting out as gay and then kind of like trying to repent and be good and live a celibate single life. And then, so I don't know, it felt like almost felt like a bunch of addicts who were constantly relapsing and then getting clean and then relapsing. That's almost how they viewed it. But no one that I talked to ever even indicated that they thought you could be cured.
Yeah. Yeah. And what's so tragic there is, like, you know, I can see how someone might spin up a story about how it's an addiction and I've relapsed and I need to do something, you know, oh, I've been so terrible. And it's such a like all in your head sort of thing. Like it doesn't have to be like that. You know, it's, you don't have to have the guilt and stress of relapsing. You can relapse into it and enjoy yourself.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So yeah, I came back from that and I said, I didn't see anybody who's repaired, but I needed to buy a little more time before I made a quick exit from home because I was living at home. So I agreed to read one of the books on reparative therapy. And again, with that, there was no answers. There was nothing that was like, and you'll do this and you'll never feel gay again. It was just kind of coming up with a list of excuses or things to blame for being gay. And so after I read that, I said, okay, so it's basically blames four things. You had a domineering mother, a uninvolved father, you weren't popular at school, and you weren't good at sports. I said, even if all four things were true, there's no answers. Then what? There's nothing that the book provides where you're like, and now you'll be cured. It's just trying to diagnose something, but it leaves you there with just like, and now you'll just have to live with this for the rest of your life. So it was not long after that that my mom and I, things were getting worse and worse. And so I kind of quickly had to make an exit from home, through my bedroom window, with a bag of stuff into my car. And, that was the last time I was there.
Wow. You did like snuck out like in the night?
No, it was during the day. Things were getting kind of heated, and I had been given an ultimatum that I needed to leave. And so I knew that that was going to happen soon, and I was kind of prepared for it, but an argument got particularly bad. So I just left.
What did you bring with you?
Not a lot. You know, I had some clothes, a few personal items, and that was it. There's actually a lot of stuff that I had that I'll never see.
Did you bring your violin?
I did. Yes, I brought my violin. I forgot to say that. Yeah, I did bring my violin with me. I did think of that. I wasn't going to leave that.
Where did you go?
To a friend's house. So I had a friend whose grandmother had a home with a guest suite or a little guest house on the property. So I was able to move into that instantly. And I stayed there for about a month while I tried to figure out what I was going to do next in life. Because that happened all so suddenly, kind of my journal being discovered and then things falling apart, going to the conference, things falling apart, escaping out the window. I was really in shell shock for a while. So I was trying to figure out what in the world I was going to do with my life now, because I basically needed to reconstruct it from the ground up.
Was music a comfort to you?
Oh, very much. The fact that I still had my students to teach, I was still playing, provided some consistency, which I'm so glad I had, because apart from that, I would have been really lost. But I still had both of those things. None of that changed. And so I'm so grateful that I had that constant there.
Mm. Yeah. It sounds like you had some structure in your life. And then were there works of art, like musicals or like pieces that were comforting for you to turn to then?
Oh, so growing up, homeschooled in our family, we didn't watch a whole lot of movies and TV shows. So what I started doing was kind of catching up and making up for lost time. And I started watching some TV shows I'd wanted to see and some movies. We didn't have a TV growing up as kids. So it was not on. The TV was just not on. And our days were really too busy with school and the violin to watch a lot. My parents had a little TV DVD combo unit that wasn't hooked up to anything. They just like roll it out of the closet and we could put on a movie and, once a week and that was it. So for me, it was really just exploring this whole new world of movies, TV shows, music that I had kind of like seen or heard on advertisements and had wanted to watch or see or try. And so it was really fun.
What did you discover?
So my family has a huge appetite for comedies. So my first show I went to was The Office. I had seen little bits and pieces of that, but I had not been able to watch the whole thing through. So I bought, I think, the entire Office series. I paid some horrible price for it. And I watched through that thing and laughed. I thought it was amazing. It was so funny. We didn't see a lot of violent films either. And the next films I'm about to say are going to show you what I think of violence. Because for me, like, violent films was like the Bourne series, the Bourne trilogy. Mm. Those aren't violent, super violent films. But for me, with my upbringing, they were a little, but I love them. So I watched like the Bourne series, and because I enjoy a little action. I caught up on the Dark Knight trilogy. Absolutely love that. I tried some Lord of the Rings. Just all kinds of movies, different genres.
Lots to discover there.
There was, yeah, there was. And, you know, and I was kind of picky, so I'd be like, nope, didn't like that movie, not going to finish that one. Next. Because I was like, there's a lot to get through, and I'm not going to watch one that's just not speaking to me, so.
Did you find any gay stuff?
Oh, yeah, yeah. So I should add that I was really enjoying that. So I was finding a lot of gay short films. There were a lot of foreign language short films that I was watching. I even found some series. Okay, so there was a German soap opera that had a gay couple in it, some gay characters. And I discovered this on YouTube, and it's kind of old, but I started watching it with English subtitles and I got hooked. So I was following along this, and people would upload to YouTube just their part from the soap opera. They would edit out the rest of it. So I would, you know, just look all over YouTube trying to find these episodes. And I really enjoyed that, because to me it was like a little TV show I could watch that had these cute gay characters, and watching them develop.
Did that give you a sense of what sort of world might await you as a gay person?
Oh, yeah. You know, that created such longing and desire in me that this is what I wanted. I wanted that for myself, and feeling like I had to wait so long to come out, and it was really traumatic. I was like, okay, now now this is what I want. So, you know, I'd watch some of those things and I'd cry, or I'd watch some of those things and I'd laugh. But, you know, there was always that sense that this was something that I wanted for myself.
And what was that like? What did you think was going to, what world did you think you were going to step into once you were ready to, you know, be an out gay man?
You know, I didn't really know. I wasn't sure, and I'm pretty good at taking things carefully. So I was like, okay, I'm freshly out. I'm not going to go wild. I'm not going to do anything crazy, but I just want to start learning more about this world. So I started dating. I think just all the typical stuff, trying to meet other gay people, because that was a new experience for me, making friends. So yeah, it was a really, you know, those first 5 years were a great time, kind of stepping out into this new world, but also a time where a lot of healing needed to happen, because I had a lot of issues that I needed to deal with from my past, and I didn't want to move forward without addressing those and dealing with those.
And where were you like during that time? Were you like in a big city or just like somewhere more isolated?
So no, I was in a smaller city. So I didn't have access to, like Seattle, all the gay culture in a wonderful big city like this. So it was like only when I would visit, you know, a big city like Seattle or New York City that I would get to experience some of those bigger things. But you know, I immediately started dating. I downloaded Grindr as fast as I possibly could, mm-hmm. and got on that. And that was a new experience for me, because I'd never dated before. And so, kind of learning how that, you know, the online dating world works is an experience for everybody the first time. And, you know, I was getting this, and it was fun. And there were some great people I met, and, I met my first boyfriend on there, and, you know, it was a great, fun kind of experimental new world to be in.
How did it compare with what you thought it was going to be? Like, I assume, like, growing up in a religious context, and especially after going to an ex-gay conference where you see, like, all these people who are going through it and are just very depressed, that must have set a certain expectation for you. And I'm curious, like, how, like, when you actually are out there in the world getting on Grindr and stuff, what was expectation versus reality?
You know, I didn't have a lot of expectation. I mean, I had seen clips of a gay dance club from a movie, so I knew that there were like big wild parties that looked exciting and fun and all that. I was not a huge partier, so that wasn't something I immediately looked for. I eventually did go to a couple of clubs and you know, had some fun. But I was just more interested in meeting other gays. And I think I was impressed with the diversity of our community. Because sometimes, you know, often what you see depicted in, or at least what I was seeing depicted through entertainment was a pretty narrow spectrum. So I think I was really impressed by the diversity. I met gays of all ages, of, you know, many different generations, and love that experience. You know, people that were of all different professions. So yeah, it was really the broad diversity and all the different kinds of people and temperaments and personalities that make up our community.
And you were still doing the music. It sounds like you were still doing like the classes and teaching people and finding orchestras to play in.
Yes. Yeah. So music was still a big part of my life. I was still teaching every week and performing as often as I could.
Were you still did you still like seek out musicals? I know you mentioned Book of Mormon was an important one for you.
Once in a while when a show came through, but really it was anytime I visited New York City. So for example, Paul, my current boyfriend, or actually fiance right now, and I got to go to New York City, and we tried to see a show every single night we were there. We would go to the discount ticket booth in Times Square, and we would wait for 7 p.m. on the dot, because that's 1 hour before the shows start. And at 7 p.m., they release more tickets that haven't been sold that are closer to the front for a discounted price. So we would, right at 7, run up to the window and say, "What do you have available?" And they would say, "We have this, 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 and this." We'd pick our favorite, pay them, and then we would sprint to whatever theater it was at. Yeah, so it's New York City, and that's where I usually wait till we're in New York City to see shows, because that's an incredible experience there. And it's just been a couple of times that I've seen a show that's come through either Vancouver or Seattle.
What sticks in your mind from that experience of like that sort of last minute, okay, we got the tickets, now let's run. What made impression on you?
Cynthia Erivo in The Color Purple was the most astounding live Broadway experience I've had. The Color Purple is amazing. I didn't realize sitting in the audience that she had just been nominated for, and she won the Tony for that role. So I only found out afterwards because I looked her up and I said, "That was so amazing. She better win something for it." And I was like, "Oh, she's been nominated." Mm-hmm. The Color Purple was beautiful. It was the most simple set. There were no scenery changes. It was a single wall with these random chairs hung on it all the way up to the ceiling. And they basically the actors would take the chairs off the wall, hang them back up from various times to create every scene. The acting was so good. The singing was absolutely phenomenal. I mean, there were several standing ovations during the show, which is something I'd never experienced. Mm. And I was told that doesn't even happen often in New York City. But it was so good that the entire performance was interrupted by standing ovations. And that was the most moving experience I've had at a live Broadway show. Her voice was tremendous. But on a very different vein from that, the most I have ever laughed was The Book of Mormon. Just watching that show, I just could not stop laughing. I told Paul afterwards, my cheeks hurt so much from laughing. I just don't want to smile for a week.
I just like took so much joy took a lot of energy just to experience that joy.
It did. I was like, "Oh wow, my face is so tired. I've been laughing and smiling so hard."
You mentioned that that was a time that required a lot of healing from what you'd been through. It sounds like that was, you know, both experienced the catharsis of The Color Purple and the, I guess there's a different sort of catharsis of the comedy of something like Book of Mormon. But was that helping you sort of rebuild and move on?
Yeah, I think all those experiences were. But you know, in addition to that, I'm a firm believer in therapy. So I knew right away that I wanted to go see a therapist. I had a lot of issues from my upbringing that I wanted to deal with. I wanted a professional to look at. I didn't want to try to wade through this on my own. I was getting books, self-help books, because I love reading, and I had been starting to read some to kind of help myself transition from the past to this new life. But I really decided I wanted someone with a lot more experience and also someone with an outside perspective to look at things with impartiality. And that was invaluable. You know, anybody who's going through big events like that, I cannot recommend. I'm always telling people, you know, go see a therapist. You know, you take your car in to see a mechanic regularly, take yourself in, you know, for a checkup, make sure things are good. And especially if you have a problem with your car, you take it in right away, you know, treat yourself well. So I think it can really help you get perspective on life, help you see things you weren't, deal with past traumas. And yeah, it was life changing.
Well, that's great. It sounds like there's a lot of work that, you know, not to sell yourself short, that you were doing as well to, you know, make use of the perspective you get in therapy. But having that assistance there, you know, you're not the first person to tell me on the show that, like, it gives you the tools that you need to figure yourself out.
Yeah. Yeah, it really does. And, you know, and you're in your head so much, and you're, especially when you're not out, you're in your head as a gay person for so much of your life, and then you finally come out and you're trying to figure it all out. I think our perspective can sometimes be muddied or muddled. And it just helps so much to have an impartial person from the outside say, you know, this is the way it is. You're not messed up, or, you know, this situation is wrong, or, you know, here's, maybe this is a way to deal with this. It was wonderful.
Well, it sounds like being in your head is sort of the experience that you had with the silent retreat, that gave you some time to really listen to yourself. So I wonder to what extent that got you sort of like part of the way there, and then having some outside perspective it pulled you out of it to get, you know, sort of a more bird's eye view.
Yeah, exactly. It was that silent retreat that really first got me to just get some quiet time and really take the time to deal with myself and listen to what was going on. And then writing about it really helped me clarify and crystallize a lot of what was going on.
Tell me about how you met Paul.
So that was also Grindr. Thank you, Grindr. Grindr is not sponsoring this show, unfortunately. So I was living in a little town up by the border of Washington State and British Columbia, Canada, and there was not a lot going on Grindr up there. So I decided to try Grindr Extra. When I did that, I was like, oh, this is such a scam. This is not going to do anything for me. But I was like, oh, there's a lot more guys I can see on here. And I was reaching from like North Seattle up through Vancouver. So I was pretty excited. So as I was going through that, I came across this account with this guy who was an artist, had some really cool art. He was into exercise. So he had just ran a marathon. He loved eating well and had all these pictures. He had his Instagram account, a link to his profile, all these pictures of him making green smoothies at home. And I was like, oh, this is really cool. He's an artist like me. Enjoys staying fit, exercising, getting exercise, and eating healthy. And he's legally blind. WTF, how is that possible? How is he doing all these things and he's legally blind? So we started messaging, and we messaged back and forth for about a month, I think. And then he deleted his account. So he disappeared off of mine. And I think it was a month or two later that I thought of him again. And I thought, I wonder if he's back on. So I searched through my little chat history, and I found him, and I sent him a message, and lo and behold, he was back. So he said hi. So I thought, okay, this time I have to nail this guy down. So I said, let me come up and meet you. Let's have lunch or coffee. And he was like, sure. He's like, I'll give you an art lesson. I said, okay, well, I'll bring my violin and play my violin for you. So I showed up there. It was actually only a 35-minute drive. So it wasn't too bad. I arrived. We had a great time. He had this amazing lunch prepared for me and green smoothies. And he taught me to paint. I actually painted a little canvas that we still have. And then I played my violin for him. And then we went out for a walk. And he was going to bring his cane with him. But I thought he was kind of cute. So I said, don't bother bringing your cane. You know, you can just hold on to me. I mean, what a great excuse. I mean, what a great reason to like, I wish all of my dates had been blind. Like I said, just hold on to me. So that was really cute. And that date lasted like 20 hours. It was a long date. And from then on, we started seeing each other once a week and then a couple of times a week. And yeah, now we're going to get married this December.
Wow. Congratulations.
Thank you. We're pretty excited. It's been just over 3 years.
And you do a lot of the work that you do online. It seems like you collaborate on those things, right?
Yeah. So I think it was like a third or fourth date that Paul said to me, what are one of your dreams? What have you like music? What are your dreams regarding your music? And that's really pretty common for Paul. He likes to throw out these big questions at me and kind of make me think real hard, and sometimes I just roll my eyes at him, but we were newly dating, so I had to play along, so couldn't roll my eyes then. So I said, actually, I've always wanted to make music videos. I love the piano guys, the two cellos. They are classical crossover artists who make these amazingly fun videos on YouTube, and it's so much more fun than anything the classical community is doing. And he said, oh, that's funny. Ever since I was a kid, I wanted to be the next Steven Spielberg. I wanted to make movies, edit movies, direct movies. But when I was diagnosed with my genetic eye disease and told that I was legally blind and losing my vision rapidly and would eventually go completely blind, I decided not to pursue that career. And I'm a real kind of just dive in the deep end and do it. So I said, you know, let's do it. Let's just make one. Let's make a music video. You've wanted to do it. I've wanted to do it. We have the right combination here. Let's just do it. So we grabbed an iPhone. I recorded into my built-in laptop speaker, which was super crappy. We filmed the video. We recorded it and edited everything on free software that you can get online. And we just put this one video up on an empty YouTube channel that we just named The Shirtless Violinist, only because the Barefoot Violinist was taken. Mm-hmm. That was the name we wanted. Because we thought Shirtless Violinist was a bit too salacious. So we wanted to be the Barefoot Violinist. But there is a fiddler in Ireland who has taken that name. I was pretty upset about that, but I was forced into that. So we just, yeah, that was it.
Well, I guess like after the shoes come off, then, you only got so many choices after that.
Yeah.
So you started putting you put one up. What was the song that you did?
So this was just after, or just before the Rio Olympics, just after actually. And there, theme song. One of their theme songs that year was a song by Katy Perry called Rise. And when we were first doing this, we thought, oh, we'll just catch a popular song and we'll get views. So we thought, oh, this is going to be a popular song. you know, Rise by Katy Perry. It's one of the Olympic theme songs. So I recorded that. We put that up there. And of course, that's not a popular song. I think one person that I've ever met actually remembers it. And enough to be able to hum it. A lot of people are like, oh, I think I remember that she did a song like that. So it was, yeah, that was it. We just put it up there and we thought, we were hoping for a couple hundred views. And we got about 20,000. So we were just blown, away. We're like,
where do those people come from?
Yeah, that was our question. Like, how? We didn't understand that, like, YouTube recommends videos to people, and we didn't understand how YouTube works. So I think it just kind of like started popping up. And getting recommended, and then pride.com discovered it and wrote an article about it, which we didn't even discover till a couple of days after it was up, because we started getting more views and we were like, what's going on? Why? And then YouTube will show you where views are coming from, and it showed this external source. So we went and looked there, and so they'd written about it. So we were, I mean, that right there, that would have been enough for an entire lifetime. Just putting up one video, people enjoyed it, someone wrote about it. We were thrilled. And we only intended to make the one music video. But once the article came out, we looked at each other and we said, okay, I think we have to do another one. And that kind of became the pattern of like, let's do one more. And after, I think, four or five, it was starting to become a lot of work. And we realized that we couldn't just keep doing this on free software and filming with an iPhone. Mm-hmm. And we, you know, needed to try to step up our production a little. So at that point, we started a crowdfunding site. We used Patreon. And we had a little community from around the world of people who wanted us to keep putting up music videos, because we said, if we're going to keep doing this, we need some help, because this is a lot of work, a lot of time, and we don't earn anything from it. And so we had this little community that said, yes, keep doing it. And ever since then, we've put out a music video every single month.
How's the experience of making this art with your partner and having this audience that's so international? How does that compare with the enjoyment that you got out of music when you were young?
Oh, you know, it's different. This has been really great, and I enjoy both, and I think they complement each other in different ways. So making art with my partner is incredibly satisfying. It's a unique aspect of the way it forced us into a lot of really close situations early on. You have to disagree artistically with each other. We do that a lot. So it really, I think, fast forwarded our relationship very quickly in terms of we live together and now we work together and we're trying to make decisions together every day when we don't agree. So we had to learn to compromise very quickly, choose our battles, listen to each other. So it can be incredibly challenging at times, but we both find it really rewarding that we do have this aspect where our relationship does have a way that where we can collaborate creatively, and share in that mutual joy of creating art and putting it out there.
When you're doing that together, what is the thing that you want people to take away from it? Like, what are you giving people with your art? What's the takeaway?
Well, that's a great question, because that kind of leads to the second part of your question, where you're like, you know, what does it do for you? You know, fulfillment wise. For me, with the Shirtless Violinist, I just want people to enjoy it, laugh, have a good time. You know, I'm trying to introduce a new audience to the violin. People who don't listen to the violin, who don't listen to classical music, who wouldn't really give the violin a second glance. I have a fan who said it really well. She said, I came for the abs and I stayed for the music. So I'm really delighted when someone says that, like, oh, I actually really like your music. It's so beautiful. I've downloaded it, or I'm now listening to the violin, or I want to pick up the violin. I want to learn the violin. I'm thrilled when that happens, because that's really who I'm targeting, is people who are being introduced to a classical instrument and to violin music, acoustic violin music, for the very first time. And I want them to have fun. Our videos have a lot of humor. They're pretty campy. We don't ever take ourselves very seriously. I mean, it's a shirtless violinist. It's about as campy as you can get. So that's a wonderful experience, just having people from around the world who speak different languages enjoying the music, which is also something that, like, I've always known that music is the international language or the universal language. But just knowing that my music is enjoyed in every country, when I go on the YouTube and I look at the analytics by country, it's watched everywhere. And it's really cool to me that I know I can share a story with music that is resonating with different people. And I especially hear from people from countries where LGBT rights are not honored or against the law, and they're able to watch the videos and receive hope. And sometimes they'll message me and these beautiful, sad, heartrending stories of what it's like to live there.
Yeah, I think that's something that does set your videos apart, is so often visually they're telling a story about a same-sex relationship or romance.
Yeah, you know, that started with Beauty and the Beast, where we knew we wanted to do some Disney songs besides the pop covers and the classical. So we did Beauty and the Beast because the live action film was coming out. And we said, let's try to tell a little story, because Paul was really, really pushing for us to do kind of some short stories within the music videos. And I said, well, let's go for it. Let's give it a try. So we were looking for a Disney drag queen. The one we found bailed on us the day before shooting. So Paul said, I'll do it. So we got a old yellow prom dress from a secondhand store, got a cheap wig, plastic pearls from a party store, and he did drag for the first time. And that was our first gay love story, and it did really well. It got 500,000 views, which was, you know, unbelievable to us. And I got a lot of articles written about it, about the fact that we put this gay story in Beauty and the Beast. And so that kind of began, that was the first of many. And that seems to have resonated really well with the people who enjoy watching these music videos, as having that representation. And that was something I never thought of before starting this, was that I would have the ability to represent our community in a small way. And I'm honored, humbled, and at times it's almost scary to be able to represent our community in a public way. But, you know, I hope that my stories can make, you know, someone laugh, cry, you know, just lift them up a little. And I think we have a lot of fun just being able to tell these stories, you know, the stories that we wish we'd seen as kids growing up.
Yeah. Well, so do you have like a project that's like either like the next big thing for you, or like, do you have like a dream about like, if you could take this to the next level, like what do you want to do? What's your next big thing? That's sort of your pie in the sky goal.
Wow. Great question. So, I would love to continue to put out, gay love stories. I think it's a really special thing to be able to do. And both Paul and I love telling those and creating those stories. And he and I write the scripts, even though there's no dialogue, we still script them out. We do that together, and that's a lot of fun to kind of put our own twist on them. So I'd like to continue to do that as frequently as I can. Outside of that, I would love to be able to tour, because playing live is so special to me, to have that direct connection with the audience, to be performing, you know, right there. It means so much more to me than to make a recording in a studio where an engineer is sick of hearing me play the song for the 10th time. So I would love to be able to tour. I think live music is a special experience. A real pie in the sky idea is a kind of a Cirque du Soleil meets shirtless orchestra. That sounds like something that maybe Vegas needs, or they don't know they need, but I think they need it. So it would be fun to have a big live act that incorporates various elements.
Well, that sounds great. I would love to go see that live.
Don't know if it'll ever happen, but we like to dream big sometimes.
So if folks want to find you online, where should they go?
Well, you can see all of my music videos on YouTube. I'm Shirtless Violinist there. I try to update Instagram almost every day. I'm Shirtless Violinist there. I'm also up on Twitter, Facebook. Shirtlessviolinist.com is where you can find my CDs and some other merch. And then my patreon.com/shirtlessviolinist is where you can go to learn about the little community that helps me make these music videos.
Awesome. Well, Matt, thanks again for joining me.
Yeah, thank you, Matt.
Thanks again to Matt for joining me. There's a long tradition of queer people creating great art in the classical music world. And for my recommendation this week, look up a 2015 article in The Guardian entitled Queer Pitch, Is There Such a Thing? Composer Rolf Hind provides a fascinating overview of how a composer's sexual identity can influence their music. From the abrasive Julius Eastman, who wrote about claiming his identity as an act of violent sacrifice, to the more playfully campy Daniel Del Tredici. Rolf Hind's article is a fantastic introduction to figures you might like learning more about, and it's an excellent guide to how the notes you hear hide the whole stories of the composer's coming out process. In particular, he highlights arguments that while classical music can be a force for good in the lives of queer people can be a force for good in classical music, elevating it and making a genre that sometimes seems old-fashioned into something contemporary, relevant, and even cutting-edge. Thanks again for listening, and a quick reminder that right now we're running a Kickstarter for Dungeons & Dragons & Drag Queens on the road. Head over to Kickstarter.com and search for Queens of Adventures, A Legendary Journey for details and some fabulous backer rewards. Let me know what you think of the show on Twitter and Facebook or sewerspodcast@gmail.com. The theme song for The Sewers of Paris is Parisian by Kevin MacLeod of Incomptech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 3.0. And until next time, croissant.